Mr. Wallace, in the minds of a great many of our people, the greatest challenge facing our nation is a question of full employment. Even though we must all realize the reconversion period from war to peace is bound to cause dislocations, nevertheless, developments the past few weeks have made for additional concern. You, Mr. Secretary, in your interesting book, 60 Million Jobs, have awakened countless Americans to the seriousness of the challenge. We hope in this broadcast you will feel free to make any comments you wish on the subject of full employment as you apply it to our agricultural Midwest or to the nation as a whole, for of course it is a national problem. My own questions will deal largely with items suggested in your 60 million jobs. Perhaps as logical a way as any in which to open is to have you restate the goal as you see it.
In brief, we want continuous full employment without sacrificing free private enterprise.
Well, Mr. Wallace, how does the goal, that is approximately 60 million jobs by 1950, compare to the highest level of employment that we've known in the past?
Well, last year we had employment of about 64 million if we count in the boys in the armed services, and they were certainly employed. In peacetime, the biggest employment we ever had probably was in 1940, when I believe we had about 46 or 47 million. But at that time, there were 7 or 8 million unemployed. I think Mr. Dewey said there were 10 million unemployed. And, of course, by 1950, we'll have a substantially larger population than we had in 1940. In 60 million jobs in 1950 would be roughly the same proportion of the total population as the employment we had in 1929.
In other words, then, the goal certainly is not as out of reach as some people might have thought it to be when they first thought of it. Well, now, as to achieving that goal, just how does the challenge fit into the framework of our capitalistic system? Are we to understand that you believe we can achieve this end of the rainbow without substantial government assistance?
Well, Herb, I don't think we're going to achieve any end of the rainbow. I think the end of the rainbow will always be there, luring us on.
But we want to get as close to it as we can.
The all-important thing is to give businessmen the courage to invest. If we can give them incentive to invest, they'll do the vast part of the job. But in order that they may have courage to invest, it is essential in the economic storms that always come after a great war to give the businessmen assurance that if unemployment passes beyond a certain point, then government is ready to step in a sensible yet powerful way.
Would the plan entail inflation in any way?
No, the plan would not entail inflation. I may say that some folks are fearing inflation during this year. You may remember we had rather serious inflation in 1919, the first year after that war. But I don't think there's so much danger of inflation. That some things will be scarce. Sometimes I've said rather jokingly that the danger of inflation this year is a little bit like the situation that exists in a cold room when you have a big fire, and you stand in front of the fire, and you may feel rather inflated in front, but at the same time your rear is decidedly chilly. That is, you can have both inflation and deflation at the same time. I'm sure that the large segments of our population will be saying their inflation this year. There'll be inflation during the coming year, while at the same time there's a lot of deflation. The plan itself has adequate safeguards against inflation. The danger most to be feared is deflation.
Well, does the plan demand a considerable tax revision?
Definitely. It will be vital to make such tax revisions as will most promote the maximum of investment of private capital. Obviously, the most significant tax revision that could be made would be the abrogation of the excess profits tax as soon as all possibility of inflation is passed.
Which in turn will give business some of the confidence and the courage they need to go ahead with the...
And also, within a year or two, it would be important to remove some of these so-called nuisance taxes so as to increase the purchasing power of the average consumer.
Well, coming back to the plan as a whole, the premise, as I understand it, is that all who seek work should have a right to work.
Definitely, but please remember this, that there is no insurance to any specific individual by government. Many people have urged that every individual in the United States would come around to government and say, "Where's my job?" Nothing of that sort is contemplated. What is in mind is that government should take those actions which will best promote a favorable economic climate so that all who are worthy and really want to work can find a job.
Right. In the proposed figure, 60 million, what is the approximate makeup? How many of these workers will probably be in business? How many in agriculture, in professional work, and the like?
Well, roughly, the 60 million divides into two main categories, about 37 million in the fields of so-called labor, and about 23 million in agriculture, working for the various governments, federal, state, and local, and at housework, that is those who work for wages in the home, and the businessmen, roughly 6 million in the field of businessmen, professional men, or working in an executive capacity with businessmen.
Again, approximately how many in agriculture?
Or about 8 million in agriculture.
Well, that figure is rather comparable with the number we have now, and yet at the present time here in this particular section, we feel that we can use some more workers.
Well, undoubtedly there should be more workers in Iowa and in the Central Corn Belt. In those areas of the United States where the farms are rather small and the soil is rather poor, they've just had too many people living there to do the work to be done, and those people should find an outlet in industry. They can do better for themselves and better for the nation if they find jobs in town. I hope that that we have such full employment that we won't have so very many more than 8 million employed in agriculture. It'll be better for all of us.
At the same time, though, if we have full employment, we'll need more food, and I'm just raising the question now, will we be able to meet that demand with the suggested number we've given?
With the new machinery that's coming along, the new methods that are coming along, I am confident that we can produce all the food the people of the United States can eat when they're fully employed. That means they'll eat more than they've ever eaten before.
Right.
We can produce them with 8 million people. I have that much confidence in the new technologies.
And, of course, the making of the machines means more employment to more workers.
Yes. It does mean that some of the work is shifted from the farm to town.
Yes. I assume, of course, you're contemplating, though, that for youngsters, more time will be devoted to education.
Definitely. That the next generation is our most priceless asset, and we can well invest, nationally speaking, 30 or 40% more in education than we've ever invested. And I think there's a few school teachers that might well have their salaries raised a little bit.
I'm sure that statement will be a very popular one with a great many hundreds of the young ladies and others who are doing such a fine work teaching school under the obstacles they have here. And that statement you made concerning the investment in education, Mr. Wallace, I saw some of the younger generations on the other side of the Atlantic earlier this year, and I think the statement that you said nationally might also be mentioned internationally, though that's not a part of this discussion. Let me go back to the 37 million figure you suggested as a figure that will depend on jobs provided by business and industry. What is going to predicate the ability of the industrial and the business groups to provide those 37 million jobs? We've already mentioned taxes. Taxes being reduced. Now, are there other things?
Well, the all-important thing is to get the maximum investment of private capital. The tax modification is all-important. It also is important that businessmen have confidence. To that end, there should be a much more, a much greater interchange of opinion between businessmen and government, between businessmen and labor leaders. I think if we all set our hearts on the same goal, we'll get rid of a lot of this confusion and misunderstanding which seems to be in the, abroad in the land today. I've talked with a great many businessmen and a great many labor leaders in the last few months, and you find yourself in a position of sympathy with both sides, and yet feeling that there's been insufficient interchange of information between the two groups. They just don't understand each other. I feel that the Murray Full Employment Bill, together with some of the other measures sponsored by the administration, will tend to bring about a better interchange of information between these groups in the months immediately ahead. I hope so, at any rate.
Yes. Well, we're going to have to carry on rather hurriedly now on some remaining questions I have in mind. I would, though, like to ask, do you propose a guaranteed annual wage or minimum return of some kind?
Well, in many lines of business, a guaranteed annual wage would be a very great help, especially in the construction business. There are other lines of business which are seasonal in nature where it'll be impossible to have a guaranteed annual wage.
And where approximately do you think wages should seek a level at the present current rate or higher or lower?
It'd be very helpful to both the businessman and the farmer if the total payrolls of labor could be maintained pretty close to where they have been during the past year. In other words, as the hours of labor are reduced, it is important that the basic wage rate be somewhat increased. Many of the larger corporations of the country have recognized this and have increased the basic wage rate at the same time as the hours of labor have been reduced. This definitely tends to sustain farm product prices and business profits. Of course, we recognize that there are certain lines where it is impossible to maintain the payrolls, simply because the government has stepped out of the picture.
In your book, you spoke of human frontiers. I wish you'd elaborate just a little on a few of those points.
Well, I don't have time to do that, Herb, but possibly the most significant human frontier is the health frontier. About a third of us are enjoying substandard health.
Did you say enjoying?
Well, to listen to some folks, you might think they enjoyed it.
Yeah. But we'd better use the term advisedly, though.
Yes, indeed. They could have health no end better. Medical service could be more available in many communities than it ever has been. Hospitals could be more available. It would be a splendid investment for the entire nation if we had more universal medical service available, more universal knowledge of dietary laws, of the use of vitamins, and so on and so on. This frontier, while it might cost several billion dollars to conquer, would increase the productivity as a result of the better health much more than that.
Well, the atomic bomb cost us some $2 billion to produce, and I'm sure that a lot of people feel that we ought to be willing to spend an equal amount, at least, for some other things that are likewise very, very important in our picture. You spoke about health. That, too, of course, would include nutrition. That is the achieving of a better standard of nutrition.
Yes, that is far more important than 99% of our people realize.
Is there a point you might wish to make about projection of our plan into the foreign field, foreign trade, or something of that nature?
If we have real confidence with regard to peace, we can export. And if we have no economic warfare between the nations, we can find a market abroad for $10 billion worth of stuff, or $7 billion more than we had during the years immediately preceding the war. That can furnish employment perhaps to, as many as 5 million people. And that's very, very significant, especially to the farmer. Many of our farm people have been dependent on the export market.
Certainly that is a substantial figure to think about. Finally, Mr. Wallace, what is a price we as a nation may expect to pay if we fail to accept the challenge before us, the challenge of achieving full employment?
Well, if we go down to employment like we had in 1932, the price would be very, very great indeed. Not merely in dollars, but in terms of our social structure. I can't sufficiently emphasize the just what the price would be. In terms of dollars, I do know that it cost us more than $300 billion in the decade of the 30s. But the more significant cost would be in our social structure. That would be difficult indeed.
In the heartaches as well as in the dollars. Thank you 1,000 times, Secretary of Commerce Wallace.